This episode's guest is Tom Tomlinson. Tom is the senior strength and conditioning coach for the England men's rugby team. I first met Tom back in 2017 at an apprentice coach program hosted by Altus during my internship with Altus. And I instantly knew Tom was a person I could connect with on many levels from the interactions and conversations that we shared during our time together at Altus. On this episode, we discuss Tom's background. I asked Tom what is his current training model, how Tom assesses and monitors his players with the England rugby team. I asked Tom about his experiences working under different head coaches. I asked Tom how his ideas on speed development have changed over his career. How involved is Tom in the technical and tactical preparation of the team? What happens after a major tournament with the England rugby team? How much contact does Tom have with the players when they are back with their clubs? I asked Tom how does he look after his own health and well-being? How does Tom build relationships with his co-workers? And finally, I asked Tom what were his current and top book recommendations. Guys, this is a great episode with Tom, and I hope you really, really enjoy the show. Okay, Tom. Can't believe, I know you 7 years now, and we've never done a podcast till now. So I really appreciate making the time, particularly after a very hectic 2 months for you now, or even more.
I reckon it might be longer, Robbie, wouldn't it? Wasn't it 2016?
17. Jan 17, yeah. Yeah. I remember it well. I was only actually thinking about it today in the gym. I was like, I can distinctly remember where we were. We were in that Paradise Community College track. And I had spent like, I was on about week 6 or 7 of my internship. And all I'd heard for the last 6 or 7 weeks into that was just American accents, bar the odd European one, because there was a German guy there that was working with Andreas. Yeah. And then I just heard this booming English accent. I was like, wait, where's that coming from? And then I saw you on the far side. I'm not messing. You've probably gotten this a lot of times, but the minute I saw you, I was like, who is that giant Viking over there? Look at that man. you had your long hair again and your beard. And I think, like, I went through, like, two emotions in the one time. I was, like, delighted because, like, oh, somebody, like, from basically my side of the pond. But I was also very intimidated. I was like, that dude's big. I don't want to fuck with him. But he seems to be a very friendly guy. So I remember I went straight over to you and, like, we just hit it off right away. And you were telling me about your background. So, yeah, it's great.
It was, that was a life-changing experience to me, that ACP.
Yeah.
I came back from that very inspired.
Yeah. I remember the deep conversation we had about Bosch, which we might touch on later. It was funny. Me, you, Dan Pfaff talking about Bosch. And like, because at that time, Bosch was getting big. I remember that.
Yeah. Well, it was like a nebulous concept at that point, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember Stuart was quite into some of it, wasn't he? I mean, he probably still is. I'd never met anyone like Dan or Stuart prior to that.
Yeah. I'd only discovered him. Well, I knew of Dan since about 2000. Well, I knew of Stu and Dan since about 2012, just when they finished up London. I don't know about you, would you ever get like these, like, whenever I was like, if only I knew in like 2009 who they were, I could have like went over while they were there. And it's like, I found out too fucking late. But yeah, like, I mean, when you meet them, like I was so fortunate to spend that time with mainly Stu, because Dan was kind of back and forth from Texas to Phoenix at that point. But yeah, exactly. You're just like, oh, if I could just like live with these guys like all the time, like it's just,
I know.
Yeah.
I'd love to go to Atlanta. I don't know anyone that's been to the ACP since the move to Atlanta.
I don't personally know anyone, but I know of some. There's an Irish guy who did do it. I think it was Colin Brady. I think he was actually with Italy Rugby, this guy. I'll have to check that out for you later. I'm not sure. And there was an English guy there, because Stu was telling me there was an English and Irish guy there at the same time.
I think it was the your man from Arsenal.
Could have been, yeah.
Yeah, because, oh, shit. Yeah.
Yeah. So, for my listeners anyway, and for people who are going to listen to this, tell us your background.
So I'm currently with England, been with England rugby, senior men's, since 2014. Strength and conditioning, I've worn a few hats for them over the last, well, near decade. Prior to that, I was working in Super Rugby, in strength and conditioning as well, for the Waratahs. At that point, they were a pretty successful team. And then prior to that, 4 or 5 years prior to that, I was a budding rugby player, basically. I was still like scratching an itch. I wanted to be a better player than I was, which probably fueled a lot of my coaching ambition, and also because I never got the coaching that I thought people deserved at the level I was playing at. So basically, I was playing semi-professional rugby in Australia and in England. I played England Sevens on the circuit for a year, and but I was always coaching at the same time. I probably started coaching during my final years at Loughborough in my undergrad when I was about 2003, because I've always kind of loved the idea of improving things, whether that be as a player improving your game or being a coach improving, helping to support and improve a player. I love that kind of that. What I thought at the time was a linear process, it's obviously not. But that idea of, dose response and getting rewards for it. Like, even started when I was training, when I first got my first barbell set, like work, achieve. That's always been a thing for me, that I love that idea. And doing it in physical training and then rugby was the ideal job for me. And I kind of was quite aware of that since I was at school, really.
And just before we kind of touch into more your role with England, like how did you get in rugby? Was that just the environment? Was that just what you were exposed to in school? Was it a rugby school? Were your mates playing rugby? Did you play any other sports? Or how did rugby become the sport you got into?
My grandparents, my uncle, my dad were all like pro rugby. I played football, soccer at school. I preferred soccer, and I remember at one point thinking I need to decide here what I'm going to do. Let's go for soccer, and my parents were like, yeah, like, do you want to do well? Yeah, maybe you should do rugby because like people are really good at your age, and I know you scored a few goals for school at the weekend. Doesn't mean you're going to go anywhere. And I was like, okay, I played rugby and I had the physical attributes for rugby more than football. And I was quite good at rugby. And then it was basically British Bulldogs, wasn't it? Like in school playground, you play British Bulldog or whatever it called, dodgeball. And I was like, okay, this is like that. I'm okay at this. I can do that. Unless I've got to stop someone because I hate tackling. But it was, mate, I reckon I started playing when I was 8. I was sent there on a Sunday when I was 8 years old.
God, that was harsh truth from the parents, wasn't it? Nah, maybe you should just play rugby.
It was my mum. It was my mum who said that, not the guys.
A wise woman.
Yeah.
So look, I sent you over an email with some topics, and listen, you can go wherever you want with this, and we don't have to stay on
Yeah.
this line, but just love to get your thoughts on some things. So, I mean, a question I've been nearly asking everyone probably since I came across Bill Hartman's work is like, your training system, your model. I suppose if you just stand up in front of, if you were to, if someone said, Tom, I want you to give a presentation to a group on your training system, your training model, if you want to call it your philosophy, what would that presentation look like?
Yeah, okay. So I would say the umbrella term would be it's academic and yet pragmatic. So it's got to be evidence-based for me. And that doesn't have to be published. It doesn't have to be peer-reviewed. It could be someone that's been in the trenches and they've got a system or a model in place that they just know reaps a reward. And that'd be like Dan Pfaff, for example. Like he does a lot of research and study, doesn't he? He does a lot of in-house research. He doesn't publish it, but you sure as hell trust what he's saying if he's been doing it for 40 years. So it's evidence-based, but let's just say that's 80% of it, and then the other 20% is wiggle room for conceptual ideas that maybe haven't been quite haven't quite had the formal backing behind it yet, but you think there might be something in it. So that tends to be things like some special exercises, or even some of the myofascial sling focus work now that people like Danny Foley are championing, things like that. So it looks very traditional. I'd say it's very traditional. I'd like to think there's no fluff. Everything's got a purpose. But then there's also a bit in there which is a little bit, what's the word? Not risque, but a little bit, hopefully forward thinking, because I certainly can't be doing what they've been doing for 50 years, but you've got to respect it. So I'd like to think it's a good blend, basically.
It reminds me, I don't know if you got that from Stu, but it reminds me of Stu. I think Stu used to have like 80% he knows works, 15% he thinks it might give us something, and 5% he's like, I'm just trying some wacky shit here to see if
Oh
anything
yeah,
comes back.
well yeah, maybe. Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe.
Yeah. No, I'm not saying that you got that, but maybe, but again, I suppose, 80-20, it could be from that too. Like, so that could be just something like,
Yeah.
unconsciously that's in our mind. Like, so I don't know.
Yeah, with Pareto principle, something. Yeah, I do try and adhere to that. But you've got to have a bit of wriggle room. But there's programs that are just all wiggle, and there's just like some of the guys on social media now, like every video is a new exercise. You're like, I swear I've seen 150 exercises in the last month. There's no way that is in a model. And then on the flip side, there's people that stick the same program all their lives and they never budge on anything. So I'm mindful of both. But like in my environment, it has to work. We haven't got time. And you can't experiment or fuck around with people's bodies when they're at the knife edge. So it's got to be effective. I have to be sure it's gonna have impact. There's probably three rabbits I'll chase. And I'm talking like weight room here, but you could use that for everything, including field training. First one is just like maintaining general qualities in the middle of a test campaign, because you got to. And I think for the younger athletes and for the real aging sort of latter stage athletes, general training is really important. I don't know anyone that doesn't need that at that stage of their life. And then maybe the second rabbit would be exercises that are closer to some of what you might call special exercises, like if you're using Bonachuk's term, those sort of special developmental or special preparatory exercises or even competition exercises. They're things that the players can identify as being very contextual. At our level, they really want that. They don't want to be mucking around with things that is just fluffy. They really, really pay attention to what they think has got a lot of correspondence. And then the third rabbit, again, like I just mentioned, some of the more movement-focused loaded exercises that got a bit more flow and myofascial focus to them. I think there's something in that, and I've been mucking about with that for a while now, but I'm a bit deeper into it, and I really believe there's something in that because of the analgesic effect, the movement quality effect, the novelty effect, even the psychological effect it has moving without pain. We know some guys just move through pain because it's a traditional thing for them to do in the weight room. So those kind of three buckets, and I might the distribution of those will change depending on the time of the year, the length of the campaign. At the moment, I've just had an 8 week block. In the summer, I'm going to have a 4 week block. If it's a World Cup, we'll have a 6 month block. So the distribution of that will depend on the demands of the competition. And also, importantly, the focus on the game model. Are you training the game model? I have to do that. I have to do that. So with regards to game model exercises, that probably comes in the second or third rabbit, like the special exercises and the movement-based exercises. The general qualities, just they're not specific to a game model, but how much you do of them might, with terms of max strength and relevance to early acceleration and whatnot. So when I program, I've got those three things in mind, and then I alter them to the stage of the year, basically.
Okay, yeah, that's perfect. So those three rabbits, that's very, very interesting. So we have general abilities, special, more like special strength training and stuff. So as you said, more like the Bondarchuk, SD, SP or SD, and then kind of more that movement piece as well. Like you're saying, the fascial thing is kind of like the Danny Foley stuff. I haven't actually looked into any of that stuff myself, but I'm aware of Danny's work. But that's a really nice way of looking at it. So I'm very interested to very interested, like, to know, like, the again, you gave a great snapshot of it there, like the different windows of time you have to work between the Six Nations campaign to a summer campaign to a World Cup campaign, and the different ratios of how that skews. But maybe just like in the email too that I sent with the questions, like, so with the England squad there, like, how do you guys, like, I'm so interested because they come from different clubs and there's such a wide, young guys, old guys, injury histories. So, like, from an assessment standpoint, from a programming standpoint, and like sort of monitoring, like, what does that look like within your environment?
Yeah, sure. So again, depending on the campaign, my first question I ask, this is always, I always ask this to myself, and if I'm deliberating about what to do, I just think to myself, what do they need and where have they come from? So if they come from Premiership rugby, they're going to have a good background of general strength. Like, they're all going to be pushing and pulling and having a lower body key lift that's pretty competitive. Like it's a mainstay culturally in the Premiership. How they do that will be, just be down to the philosophical differences of the S&C team at the club. But I'll be fairly confident that when they come in, they've got good general absolute strength. So all I'm doing there is just maintaining that stuff on an 8 week campaign like I just had, because there's an emotional thing here. Like that, you can't take away bench from a rugby player, bench press. You can't. There's going to be a revolt. And that's just purely a psychological thing. You know, it doesn't matter what you think about it. It's more damage to take away than it is to leave it in. But I'm going to do minimal dose. So I'm going to work up to a top set, like a 5-3-1 type format, or like a Dan Baker wave. And they're going to do the least amount of work to maintain or even develop, you know, qualities in that regard. And because you're lowering the volume, and some of the players don't play an awful lot in the Six Nations, actually, some of the guys will actually see a bit of a spike. They might be coming from a program that's got a higher volume. They might be doing more sort of like 75, 85% range, and then they might hit a couple of top sets. Actually, some of the guys might be, you know, hitting PRs there. It's not because of what I've done. I've just basically offered a peaking process, really. So you've got a bit quiet there, so he can hear now.
No, it's good. No, it's me. That's me. I turn my mic off just so there's no
Oh,
background noise
sorry.
in my end. So if you see me nodding, going yeah, and you don't hear me, that's why.
Oh, no worries. So the point there is that I've got to keep that in. And again, this is just like I said, it's hormonal, it's psychological. It's not, there's not a lot of technical reasons for it. But these campaigns tend to be a peaking process. So in the autumn, we have 4 weeks. So I'm not making physical gains. I'm not making physical gains. But my ambition there, my objective there is for them to leave the gym feeling better than when they entered it. And they can't, they're not going to be grinding reps out. They're not going to be, you know, struggling with eyeballs breaking. They're going to be one or two reps in reserve for their big lifts. But they need to come out energized. So there's quite a lot of movement quality work in there that's before and after the general stuff. Like I said, the myofascial stuff, even some much more basic stuff like some of the David Gray hinge patterns that he's popularizing at the moment. And I know that stuff works because he's treating my knee for me at the moment. That's it. And some of his approach to that stuff's really, really good. And there's a lot of merit to that in the lads I'm using. So I've definitely used his influence in that regard. So in a small campaign, basically maintain and make them feel energized each session in the morning, because we train in the morning. They're basically acute energizers, the potentiation sessions really. And then if you do that properly, they actually go onto the field and they're bouncing. And then you do that over 4 weeks, you get to the fourth week, the guys are outputting some good speeds, and movement quality in the field purely subjectively is pretty bloody good. 8 week period in Six Nations, you think, oh, I've got two macro cycles here. Like we can push the dial a little bit. Again, what do they need? We'll preserve general strength, but on a minimal dose. If someone needs more sort of strength, speed, strength, if someone's needs some reactive qualities, if someone needs some bodybuilding, I'll try and make those sessions and the targeted approach for each player as bespoke as I possibly can, while still obeying the benefits of having a team orientated session, because there's a lot of competition and energy when you do that. So when you think about what do they need, it might be that they need to, in a fallow week, they might feel like they need to train hard. So we'll push them with some more general strength. But the threads are always the same, Robbie. So we'll always have those three rabbits in there. And like I said, I'm shifting between the distribution of those every 4 to 3 weeks. And then in a World Cup, you can afford to go really basic and really sort of try and widen the pyramid generally as you get to games. And then you basically, we had a lovely sort of linear process, which was still very concurrent. It wasn't blocked, but the distribution of things like general strength towards the knockouts of the World Cup just 6 months ago, we weren't doing a lot there, but we were doing a lot of transfer exercise and a lot of myofascial sling type movements. The first 8 weeks of it was very general. We used a very much like a maximum strength triphasic approach. And then you just kind of dovetail from overload to specificity, really. That's the old Franz Bosch continuum of exercise selection.
That's perfect. And just continuing on from that then, because you've obviously worked under a number of different head coaches. Like, how has that sort of been from your perspective involved with the high performance aspect of the England rugby team? Like, have you had to do, like, has it been many sort of changes that you've had to make under those different regimes? Or, you know, how is that sort of transition from each different head coaching staff?
Yeah, there has been changes. So if I go to my previous job with at the Waratahs and Super Rugby, it was just about, you know, we were just told get them fit and strong and in shape. And there was nothing really aligned to how we were playing, and there wasn't a demand for it. But what we did have is a roster of very good players that needed to stay healthy and keep them on the field. And that was my remit. They need to be healthy enough to play the way we want to play. The game model wasn't super defined. But these guys need to stay on the field. We've got Israel Folau, Drew Mitchell, Amasha Coopers, like Wycliffe Palus. These guys are prize bulls. Keep them on the field. So In those final 2 years of the Waratahs, I didn't post any numbers you'd be proud of whatsoever in the big lifts, but we're really anal about movement quality in those lifts. And I barely remember an injury that year. And in the last year, we won the title. And it wasn't because of anything that I did necessarily indirectly. It was just that those guys tended to play most games. I can barely remember an injury that season. So that was a very different approach to when I joined England, where especially under Eddie, he has a very, very strong tactical periodization philosophy. So everything was about the game, to the point where it would, give me anxiety that we're kind of leaving general qualities at the door a little bit, especially in long periods. But it taught me an awful lot about making sure that what I'm doing has connection to the field. Because in my earlier days, I was too obsessed with building up relative strength numbers in a bilateral leg lift or counter movement jump scores. And I've had some great pre-seasons where I've had some brilliant results and the team's not done well. It achieved nothing for me or for the team or anything. So the learning experience was coming to Eddie and then trying to match what we do in the weight room. And because of that, Eddie had an association with John Pryor and Franz Bosch. A lot of those exercises look like that type of exercise stream. And at the time, the skills there in sort of getting, understanding the why to the player about why we're doing it, even though at the time you might not be quite sure why you're doing it yourself, you're still figuring it out because, like I said, it was fairly embryonic at that point in time. I'm talking 2014. Like they just had the success in the World Cup with Japan, Eddie and John Pryor, and all you could see was these videos being on the YouTube video. So you were still trying to figure them out yourself. But over time, you train them, you understand what you think works, and you pick your own way, don't you? And you may leave a lot of them, but you might keep some things. So what Eddie taught me was context is everything. Context is key, and there has to be correspondence. And now I reckon I've come back into the middle somewhere now. So before early days, general stuff, tactical periodization made us super specific. And then I'm kind of in the middle ground now where I'm respecting both. And then you've got this sprinkling of some of the more progressive things, like I've mentioned before with the Danny Foley stuff, that's now in that mix with those three rabbits, trying to catch all of them now.
Yeah, it sounds similar in some ways to my own journey in that, yeah, I would have been very much at the general end of things, just classical S&C, and then got more introduced to motor learning, skill acquisition, then obviously as we spoke about beforehand, and you've just mentioned there, like the kind of tactical periodization stuff. But I remember when I first came across Franz's stuff, and listen, I still don't claim to know a lot about Franz's stuff. No, actually, I read his first book Running back in 2009, but I shouldn't have. I was nowhere near ready for that book, you know. It's
I
like,
looked at the pictures and I tried to figure out because the pictures, a lot of the pictures don't have the start and finish for the movement, do they? They just have the finish. So how did he get to there? And I have got some injuries fucking around with that stuff.
I know, but it's like, it's just a slight digression that, like, I read that book in 2009, and like now, like, I can take a lot more away from it because obviously I've more knowledge, I'm a wiser coach too. But it's like when I hear someone recommend to begin or read Supertrain, I'm like, no, do not read Supertrain. Like, you will gain nothing from that book where you are right now. But
I agree.
I remember I actually had a call with Nick Winkelmann just as like kind of Franz's stuff was really taking off around that 2014 time. It was actually 2013 because I'd just done the second phase of the AP mentorship with the when they used to be called Atleast Performance, they're Exos now, like. But and I remember what Nick said, and it really stuck with me ever since. He might remember, but it's very similar to what you said there, and that I was like, so Nick, what's the story? Like, you're good friends with Franz, like, so tell me. And what he said, Tom, and I really liked this, he goes, Robbie, don't forget, Franz Bosch is a human. And at first I didn't understand why he said that, and I was like, okay. And he goes, and then he followed up with, that means he can be wrong. And I was like, so he's like, he's like, humans have fallacies, they can be wrong. Like, so he's like, don't, like he's like, he's just basically saying, don't fall hook, line, sinker for anything ever. He's basically trying to, he's like, you don't want to be at one end of any extreme. He's like, don't be the guy who's all just me head and it's all just physical capacities you're building and forget all about the motor coordination aspect. But don't be the other guy doing it and say it's all about more coordination aspect and force output doesn't matter. So Nick, so we went through the thing, and then at the end of the call, Nick just goes, "There's Robbie." He says, "Just because I'm good friends with Franz and he's really influenced me, I haven't thrown out what's worked in strength and conditioning for decades now." But he's like, "Have I incorporated Franz stuff?" He's like, "Absolutely." Like, and that's kind of where, and that's kind of where I'd still be at it now, and that, because there is that discussion too of like, I think we had this discussion at Altus. I don't know if you remember, is that like, you know, because there's a Charlie Francis model where Charlie was like, he was like purely polar training. He was like, when we do our general stuff, it's general, and when we do our specific stuff, it's specific. And then there was other people saying, well, you could make your general stuff a little bit more specific, but then we were kind of saying, do you get into that like no man's land then, where it's like you're kind of robbing Peter to pay Paul, and you're not really getting anything in the end. So, where so I think both me, you, and maybe I don't want to speak for Nick, but it's kind of like, listen, we still have like our fundamental big rocks that have seemed to, you know, really stood the test of time in S&C. And okay, yeah, they're definitely more skewed towards building the physical capacities and the biomotor abilities. And I know someone in this is like, well, the biomotor abilities even exist? You know, it's like, is there such thing as strength, power, speed? It's like, okay, we're just classifying velocity there. That's all. We're just, it's just, that's all force at different velocities is really what we're talking about. And then at the other end, you know, there is a whole motor coordination aspect. And I will say, for me personally, you know, hats off to Bosch, because he is the person for me anyway that really brought that more to the forefront, saying, he's like, listen, absolutely, force production is important, but if you can't coordinate it into the specific movement or the skill that you're trying to execute in your sport, he's like, you are missing a large chunk here. And I do think, even though you can tell me, you might know more on this, is there any good evidence to prove this? But Franz would push that a lot of this neglect of this motor coordination aspect is leading to a lot of injuries. Like, I remember he was showing us videos of the, I don't know if you went to any of the seminars where he's like showing the videos of like ACLs, and he was like, you know, he was like, because the co-contractions weren't right, because this person's getting too much general and not enough specific. You know, again, he had no clear evidence to back that up, but he made, it was a good theoretical rationalization, if you like, you know. So, but my evolution, as I'm trying to say, very similar to you. You know, I went from just this purely general to getting more appreciation for motor control, but getting a bit then confused, saying, should I just all do motor control, or, you know what I mean? So it's kind of, I'm kind of more in the middle now as well. And again, it's contextual. Is it a novice? Are they a beginner? You know, what's their training history? There's all that to be. There's all, as you said, as Eddie mentioned, context is king, like, you know. So, interested if you have any follow-up to that.
I mean, when you're, I think it's that Kruger-Dunning effect as well, isn't it? Like when I saw and spoke to mature, more experienced coaches that were doing it, and let's just say they'd gone full Bosch, and a lot there was a lot of people that were, there's a lot of people that were. My first thought is, well, I've been coaching a couple of years. How can I disagree with this guy? So I went full into it, and then. Even though, let's just say, even though I was a guy that had come from Australia and had some success, and I didn't appreciate the things that may perhaps gave me the success. I didn't debrief them properly. I wasn't forensic and understand what worked. I just had an idea that worked. And now I'm at this level and I'm being told this needs to work. So I don't have the conviction to challenge it. I don't have the experience to challenge it. I'm going to do it. And then you find out through the school of hard knocks that it wasn't what. It wasn't this unicorn that you told it was. And you start introducing things back like you were doing before when you had some success. And hey, presto, shit starts happening. And you're like, okay, there's a balance here. But when you're watching someone on social media or you're coming in for a day, you're not seeing the balance, are you? You're seeing the stuff that gets publicized. So you're seeing the acrobat drills and you're asking what the context is behind this, and we do this and this is this extra day and we do this, but no one's saying, well, we're still speed bound. You know, they still do a couple of top sets on the on of a squat. I'm like, oh, do you? You didn't mention that. Well, you wouldn't need to mention it. But I do. And then after a while you start to do things over and over again and you understand what you think's got transfer for your context. And actually, I've kept a lot of that stuff. A lot of it I do. It's the stuff I've kept, the basic stuff. It's not the complex stuff with the dangling weights running up the steps. I now can pick that apart and go, that's just absolute fuckery. But there are some stuff that I really understand why he's doing it, and I can back that up in a court of law if I had to. And that's the stuff I've kept, and they tend to fit in that second rabbit alongside a lot of other people that have done some stuff in that realm, including Dan and Stu and Jonas Dodu and the people at UK Athletics that I'm friendly with. And again, if they serve a purpose and they wear a lot of hats, I'm doing it. But it can't be fuckery. It can't just look like it but not feel like it. And that's the best thing now, is just get the input from the player. Like, they're the coach there. Stuart McGrath's got a great quote. I love this quote. He goes, coaches can see, they can't feel. Athletes can feel, they can't see. You put the two together, get a nice mix. That's a great line. I love that line.
I actually thought you were going to give another quote with Stu's that I absolutely love. It actually in the quote, it was an answer he gave to a question, and this one I just love, and it's a common question many coaches get from other interviewers or other coaches, is like, who's been your biggest influence? And most people say, like for me and you, Dan Pfaff, or whoever else, Mike Boyle, or whoever was some of your mentors. I don't I saw I shouldn't have named two because other people are like, we didn't name me. Well, like Martina McCarthy was my first mentor. She was actually a former Olympian for Ireland, and she was a head strength and conditioning coach in the university that I initially worked in. And then Nicole Rodriguez, I have to give a shout out to, because she was actually my mentor at Boyle's. Like, she was my boss. But when Stu was asked that, now Stu obviously does say Dan, but in this particular interview, he was like, aside from Dan, he was like, my athletes. That's who I learned from. He was like, I learned from my athletes. And I was just like, that is so fucking true. And right now, as we spoke to offline, that I'm studying to become a PE teacher, and like the really, and I will give credit to, I can't speak about any other educational system in the world right now, but the Irish education system are really trying to change education for the better, in that they're trying to make it this dual relationship, that it's not the old model of, a teacher just vomiting on a class, and it's like behavioralism, and it's just like conditioned responses. They're like, you got to make it active. It has to be like, from they're looking at the constructivism model of, getting students to explore and critical thinking. And we've been talking lately about, like, it's not teacher student, it's teacher student and student teacher. It works both ways, and the teacher actually learns from the students, just like the student learns from the teacher. Like, so it's, yeah, very very reminds me of Stu when he said that. It was just like so true. Like, the people I learn from most are my athletes when I'm coaching, and my students when I'm a teacher.
No, I'll second what you said about Nick as well, because some of the things that he's published and put out there, he puts in a really nice language, in a way that's a bit more palatable than what Franz Bosch done. So I don't, I've got some presentations of Nick when he was at Exos, and I've met him a couple of times, and he talks about it really, he explains it really well, and you go, oh yeah, I get it now. It's not as dogmatic as Franz, but it's way more digestible. And but and I will say that, having read, sorry, the latter books of Franz Bosch, the learning approaches, the motor learning approaches, are probably what I've taken the most from that stuff.
Yeah, me too.
The other ways to learn, differential learning, constraint set approach, all those things, the application of them I've left, but the actual celebration of these different learning approaches, definitely, they're brilliant.
Yeah.
A
No,
lot of that.
me too, actually. And as you say that, and I don't think it's going to come to any, like, any surprise to you, or be a revolution in your own mind, because, I mean, both you and I, like, we're fully aware of, like, principles over concepts, or principles over methods. And that's kind of what you can take away from Franz, is like Franz's books, like, he speaks an awful lot about the principles of motor learning. And it's like, yeah, we can take that, and we can leave those. Like, so Franz has shown us how he conceptualizes methods to respect the principles of motor learning, and we might look at it and goes, yeah, I'm not too sure about the weights that the bands go off, but there is other ways I could apply those principles. So, like, that's what I mean. So I'm the same when I read his books, and because I've read other motor control, like, the skill acquisition book by Davids and Burton, Keith Davids and Burton and Bennett, is it Burton and Bennett, like that famous one? And I've a load of them. Like, I've got the nonlinear pedagogy, and I got, like, the Williams and Hodges skill acquisition and sport. Like, they're great books. Reading, I got reading skill acquisition like 2018 for my master's, because one of my modules was biomechanics skill acquisition, and Emily Cushion, who was, she's like, she was one of the head lecturers on that module for us. Like, she was big into S or to the skill acquisition. So I really got into, like, the motor and literature. And when I went back to, like, Bosch's books, particularly his last studio, about the anatomy of agility and the strength training coordination one, like, when I read those, I was like, because I'd gone through that part of my master's and read more on the skill acquisition, I was like, I can really start to understand and appreciate, like, these motor control principles more. Like, so, like, when I first read about, like, attractors and fluctuators, I was like, what the fuck is this? Like, what's he talking about? That dynamic system theory. But then it's like, oh, like, they get, like, the more you get exposed to it, it's like Daniel Kahneman talks about in Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow. He's like, it's called cognitive dissonance. So he's like, when you're reading a book and you see like a word and like, or a really funny like Russian name, and he's like, you just go, and Dimitri, blah, 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 blah. It's like your brain just shuts off because you're like, I'm not even going to try and attempt to pronounce that.
That's right. Yeah.
Because it's like the first time you see it and it's so foreign to you, he's like, it's cognitive dissonance. You don't have any representative model to relate to this. So you're just like, I don't want to have to critically think here. I'm just going to be lazy and skip over it. So, like, when you hear about dynamic systems here, attraction fluctuates for the first time, it's like hearing Russian or Spanish for the first time. You're like, I don't know what's going on here. So you're like, this is uncomfortable because it's not familiar to me. But then when you read more, when you see, oh, here's dynamic systems here again, oh, attractor fluctuators, I heard that before. And then it's like, oh, there it is again. And it's like, what exactly is an attractor? And like, oh, it's like these specific states that your body goes into for, and then like a fluctuator is a perturbation and like the wells, and you just see it over and over again, and then it becomes, oh,
When I saw those wells, I felt like I was getting it. And then when I saw the wells with the little balls in them, I was like, what the fuck? It looks like nuclear fission. I'm way more confused before I saw that picture.
I know, I know. But I mean, but sorry, just to wrap that up, the principles that Franz talks about in terms of the principles of motor learning can definitely take from. But then, like, once you know those principles, you can then decide the certain methods that you want to take from those and try to apply those in your own environment and your own context too. Like, because I know some people can look at how Franz, I think that's what Nick was getting at too. He's like, okay, Franz has interpreted those principles and these are the methods that he uses. So, like, the bands and with the co-contractors, like, but there are other ways you can work with co-contractors and not have to go so extreme, maybe with like really unstable sort of, weights bouncing off a bar or other ways to do that, So,
It's 100%. You also don't want to overcoat contract. Your muscles need to relax. There's loads of research on that as
100%,
well. So
100%,
people are getting obsessed with co-contractions to stiffen a joint. Well, fuck me, if you stiffen that joint up a lot, what did the Soviets look about in the 1940s? It was relaxation rate. There has to be a difference here.
But
So
that goes to the Russian, or not the Russian, the Australians work with low back pain and the high threshold, low threshold stuff, if that was the Australians. But there is that conversation about, people who have had a back injury and that like their intrinsic stabilization system, the timing is off. So what happens is their external musculature just compensates by staying like in this co-contracted state all the time. So like your external obliques, your rectus, your erector spinae, they just kind of stay in this continual contracted state because the deep stabilization system, their timing mechanism is off, and to protect the spine, they just stay co-contracted. And actually,
Been there, mate. Been there.
That can cause disc degeneration because it causes a constant compressive stratory. Like, it's like a kind of like an analogy is like you shouldn't need to brace to pick a pen off the ground, you know what I mean? So if you're having to stay in that state all the time, like, and that's a co-contraction.
Yeah, I've been there, mate. And in a different way, you can think of your hip and knee joints like that if you try and do too much motor moron training, or if the perturbations are too extreme at endpoint. You're going to slow down early to get to it because you're worried about basically stability.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Moving on for the sake, and it's a nice segue to, talk about Altus and Franz and all that. An area of your development, and I think it aligns well with mine, is how you've evolved your model with regards to speed development. Very interested to hear about that. So, like, where you were maybe 10, 12 years ago as a coach and with speed development, because I think that's an area you've put a lot of continual and professional development into, is getting better with the speed and agility work. So how has that sort of evolved as your time as a coach?
I reckon it's followed a similar but more extreme pattern to my philosophy in the weight room. So I was very much about linear speed, is a physical underpinning. Accelerate and get to tops, even just accelerate. Accelerate, great. Do all of the basic stuff, all of the first generation KPIs to early and late acceleration. And then alongside this, the push to be more quote unquote specific, I started doing the things with the plates and running over hurdles or bands between the leg between the hips while passing to a partner and all these things to make it look more like it was corresponding to the game to serve that master. And speed times were terrible; they were going down. And performing an A skip while doing a plate rotation, the A skips were fucking shit. I can't justify what's happening here. Like, surely they need to A skip first before they A skip with a 15 kilo plate haloing around the head. Surely, like, it just makes sense to me that they've got to do that first. And if as long as these guys' bodies aren't completely, like I just used before, motor moronic, they're going to be able to turn their hips to pass because you know what? They're at the elite level and they've been doing it for 20 years already. And I'm pretty sure they can pass. I'm not sure doing an A-skip where you're moving over the ground at 2 meters per second, with tiny ground contacts, or tippy tapping on the ground with a 5 kilo plate. I'm not sure this is doing anything at all, but I definitely was seduced into thinking it was. So I spent a few years doing all that stuff and completely neglecting just pure acceleration. So now I've gone a bit like I said with the weight room, I've gone back to there. I'm definitely doing way more just pure acceleration. These guys are touching a ball hundreds of times a week. They're doing small-sided games. They're doing tactical games. They're getting loads of context. I just need to give them the quote I used before. I need to give them what they're not getting. And that might mean that some guys might just need to do some 90% efforts because they're not getting up to it, because the game didn't give them it. The conditions weren't appropriate. The turf wasn't appropriate. Just the way the game went, it wasn't appropriate. They might have had a niggler one day when there was time to do it, and then they come back to it and they haven't done it again. I just need to give them what they're not getting. And again, funnily enough, speed times went up. And I still do a little bit of the constraints-led stuff. I still do some low decision-making attacking drills through like gates or with hurdles with the ball. They emphasize bang, 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 just speed of execution. But I'm definitely not going over that threshold where it becomes fuckery. The first thing is first, is the movement speed and execution good? Is what I want. I can play around with failing at that little bit. I can challenge it a little bit more by adding in some tools that I've learned over the years for people like Nick and Franz Bosch. But I'm not going to deviate from what the main thing is. The main thing is to just execute and move as fast as possible and try and push the dial in that regard. So, answer to your question, Robbie, it's like the weight room, but probably more extreme. And it's probably about that 90, 10% basic traditional and some open interpretation for the last 10%.
Brilliant, brilliant. And then again, kind of leading on from that then, so because we're kind of nearly getting more specific as we talk here, we start off with your evolution in the weight room, evolution there with speed now. How much integration do you have with the actual tech coaches? Because I've seen some videos of you working with the fullback with the boxing gloves, and it was kind of it was good timing too, because lately, right now in college in this semester, we're going through modal learning, and one of the kind of labs we had there, our head lecturer, he did a very clever thing. Like, he gave us all these papers and get into groups, and we had to work out different scenarios. And one of the scenarios he gave us was an out half who kept dropping passes late on in the game. How from a kind of constraints-led approach could you manipulate something in his training for that? Like, and basically he wanted us like to come up with some kind of like specific training activity that we could do maybe to help him later on in games stop knocking the ball on, like, or missing passes. So he actually said he kept dropping catches, and I say catches, I've said that right, bad pronunciation. But so I was like, an out half? I was like, do you mean a fullback? And he goes, no, he keeps dropping catches. And I was like, do you mean passes? So in my head, I was thinking like high kicks, you know what I mean? So a catch means like you're catching a kick, but he meant passes. So we're like, okay, because like I was like, okay, that makes sense, because your 10 usually wouldn't be under any high balls, like. And but anyway, he wanted us to, and so the question was like, how can you improve his haptic touch under fatigue? So basically, we're like, right, well, he needs to be fatigued, and then haptic touch. And the scenario he came up with was like, take away, he had to wear like these gloves to constrain like his sense of the ball, but leave the fingertips like on the ball, like, and stuff like that. And it instantly made me think of you with the boxing gloves, though, with the fullback. And then, so a question I wanted to ask you when we got a chance to talk was like, how much integration do you have with the skill with the technical tactical coaches out on the pitch? Do you do much stuff there with the guys skill wise, or like how does that look, or how's that integrated, or do you maybe if someone's coming back from rehab, do you take more maybe technical tactical stuff, or how does that look?
I would say that I've got a high involvement in anything that probably doesn't require tactical decision making, because that's the threshold where I think you're crossing into the skill technical tactical domain, which is not my skill. It's not my major skill set. I could probably do it at a lower level, but for these guys, it wouldn't wash. So what I'd say is my involvement depends on how you've gone through the task diagnosis. So, for example, let's just say someone's got something they want to work on. At the start of the campaign, we've identified that this player wants to work on his attacking agility. He needs to beat more defenders. In an ideal world, and we've done this in the past, there's quite a thorough process by which we determine what's the problem, like what is the actual issue. And we start with the question, what's the major error here that we want to correct? What is it we need to sort out? What is the major error? And we'll go through a process that we got this process from Damien Farrow, the skill acquisition coach from Australia, like basically asking, is it a physical limitation, physical capacity or physical capability? Is it a cognitive, perceptual, decision-making, psychological barrier? Or is it a technical problem? Do they have the physical and the cognitive capacities, but there's a technical problem here? You go through that process and you do it with real rigor and not just superficially, and you use all the information you've got to hand to come to the conclusion. And then you find out, right, this guy's attacking evasion, it's a mate, let's just say it's majorly a physical problem. And that means I'd lead on that. But because what we're going to do with this player needs to be very contextual, the skills coaches are going to be involved in that as well. They might have a minor role. And then there might also be a situation where the major issues are physical, sorry, a cognitive one. Maybe it's where players had a compound fracture of their lower limb and they do not want to step hard off their right leg. And maybe they would be able to back up to a position where he's pretty equal left to right. And he's got the ability, but he's got some kind of top 6 inches block. The psychologist is going to lead on that, but we're going to support because there's a continuum of this stuff, isn't there? Like a physical skill is still a physical task. There's not just, you don't just cross the line into one or the other. It's a continuum. But the bias on what I can do to help and what the skill and the psychologist can do to help is going to be weighted depending on how you've gone through that process. So we go through that process and then we basically use a hell of a lot of video and footage. We bring the player in, we suggest the drills, we try them, and they'll say, yeah, love that. That really feels like it to me. We make sure there's plenty of failure, 15 to 30%. We periodize the drills based off the theme of the week. So it's got to fit in with the tactical periodization of the week, whether it's with regards to how physical and fast and how complex it is. And we keep on reassessing for change through training, like specific training drills and the game. And we just keep on auditing and analysing each week, changing the distributions, looking for transfer, getting opinions from the player about subjective interpretations of how much he's been challenged. Definitely using the skill coach to say, "Oh fuck it, he saw that. He's getting there's some change going on. He did it in that session. Did you see that?" And that's an opportunity to jump straight in immediately and reinforce it with the player if you're at hand, because immediate feedback is really, really valuable. And that's kind of the process, really. The example you used with the boxing gloves, that wasn't a emotional problem. That wasn't a psychological problem. It wasn't really a physical one, but he did have a technical problem in that he was like grabbing with his fingers. He was almost trying to catch the ball like he was catching an Easter egg. So you take your hands out. So that was me assisting it. But I remember at the time it was the skills coach that introduced that concept because he just wanted to bring the ball in a little bit closer to his body. This player was used to catching overhead a lot. He didn't actually bring it in. So we wanted him to bring it in. So he took his hands away. Now, why that drill worked is because it was the kick length and the kick height and the kick aggression was still exactly the same as a game. His approach to it and the speed of it and the height he had to jump to was exactly the same as the game. All he did was just create a tiny constraint, but not so much that it, like I used that term before, it didn't become fuckery. So for me, it worked. And you know, he started doing it in training and games. So that was how you measure transfer. It was really simple.
Yeah, I thought it was such a clever constraint when I saw it. Like, because that's I've seen that done before. Exactly. That was I seen it done another player before. And that was the reason why that he wasn't. Yeah, you want when that ball's coming, you want to hug it. It's not your hands that are catching it. It's your. So you got to take the hands out. I remember seeing it going. That was so clever because that was the answer I initially gave to into my professor in the class. Because again, I thought because again on his question it said he keeps dropping catches, and I was like. I think he and I was. I thought he made a mistake saying out half. I was like, he must mean the fullback here. So then I was like, but put on a pair of boxing gloves, and he goes, and he again. So in his head, he was like the 10 dropping passes, and he's like, not quite boxing gloves. What else could you use? And then I was like, are we talking about the fullback here? Or like, so we cleared it up. I was like, oh, you mean he's dropping like actual physical passes, like, cause, but because it was that that came into my mind straight away. I was like, that's. I remember the boxing gloves, and I thought it was so clever. So
Well, you
yeah,
know,
that's.
the interesting thing there, Robbie, was that when we first started discussing this, I remember the head coach at the time was saying you need to work on his jumping because he's not getting high enough. And you know, we could have gone down this route where he ended up doing all of this approach jump work, like in a high jump, And I was and so when we looked at it though, when we looked at it and we really got into it, and there was a lot of debate around this one, it was because of his hands. And luckily we had an AFL coach in our staff at the time that kind of led us down that way. And when we, you know what, when we put the gloves on, he could jump higher. He wasn't jumping high because he was coming overhead and he was waiting for the ball to come down. So looking at it at face value, go, he used to jump high. He didn't need to jump higher at all. That wasn't the problem. So that's why you keep coming back to that question, what is the major error? Look at all your evidence and be really thorough, because there's worst thing in the world. In an international campaign, you end up going down the wrong track and wasting all this time on something that doesn't work. The player loses interest, loses trust. You don't bother anymore. It's damaging. So that's the biggest thing. You've got to make sure it's accurate what you're training.
Yeah, class. All great. This has been a savage conversation. Really, really, really good stuff. What shifting gears slightly now, more kind of into suppose more you personally. So Six Nations has just finished. Like, that must be a big come down, like, just from the last number of weeks. So like,
Yeah.
what does the next number of weeks now or months look like for you now? Like, so obviously is there a little more family time? Is there a debrief too? Like, is there a debrief after Six Nations and then sort of everyone parts ways for a little bit, and then obviously you get the ship back on the road when the next campaign comes along?
Yeah, we have a cold debrief, so that'll be next week, so about 10 days after. And then right now we're just sort of collecting information, getting your notes together for the review. And once that's done, take some time off. So I've got a week away, and then you get back, and immediately eyes and thoughts are on the next campaign, which for us is the summer. We've got Japan and New Zealand in their back gardens, so you just shift as soon as you get back from leave. You'll shift into that, and it's all prep work for that.
And Tom, how much contact do you have to keep with the players when they're back at their clubs, or is there like check-ins just so like, you know, it's like how much contact is there between the whole staff, like from say Steve to the high performance staff to the players when you're not together, like maybe you guys don't have to do this like the S&C staff, but are the skill staff, like, are they always like watching the club games, obviously to keep on top of the guys? And are you like keeping contact about injuries with guys, or just are you checking in
Yeah.
with guys? What does that look like sort of when they're out from the England camp, if you know what I mean?
Well, the rugby coaches will watch every game every weekend, and then they'll chat talk about them and whatnot. They'll debrief them together. I watch most of the games. I'm heavily invested in it now. We'll meet as a group every sort of fortnight, whatnot. Management every few weeks.
And is that in person or would it be Zoom? Because people be different places, would they? Or
In person every 2 weeks, probably.
yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's necessary. Any more, and if it needs to be more frequent, it would be online. And with regards to the players, you kind of leave them alone for a little bit now. We've had them for 8 weeks, so I like to leave them alone for a couple of weeks, and unless they come to me, in which case I'm always available. And then I might just check in with them in a few weeks to see how they're tracking informally. You've got to be respectful of the fact that, they're serving. And they're playing for another team at the moment, and they've got different goals and approaches right now. So I'm wary of stepping on people's toes and trying to push my agenda too much. But you basically just offer support and check in. If they need your help, they know you're there. And then as we get to playoffs and some teams start to have their last couple of games, and if they're not as important as being in a semi-final or final, you're starting to push the dial on what you want them to refocus on for our campaign, which might only be a month or 3 weeks later.
It's funny, as you're speaking there about, you know, kind of almost being respectful not to you know, be overly like not to be in touch with them too much. There is that, yeah. It is very important to be like to be aware of that as the coach. Like, you could be thinking, you know, you're just doing a goodwill thing. Oh, I'm checking in, making sure you're all right. But to them, they're like, oh man, leave me alone, will you? I'm with my club here. And yeah, so I like that's a very important thing to get across as a coach, because you might think your intentions are good and pure, and they are. But to the player, they're like, dude, come on. Like, I was with England, or not England, but any. I was with your setup for the last few weeks. I'm back in my club now. I, you know, just let me focus on this. Or, but you know, in your head, you're like, oh, I'm just checking in, you know, making sure you're all right. So again, it's very. I like the way you know that you've. Either that's something that you've developed an awareness of, or you just naturally have, but I think that's a very important thing to touch on there too,
No, it's important that one because I'm mindful of that. Like the players I know really well that I've been with for years.
Yeah.
That's fine. I'm very familiar with them. I'm friends. Like I'll know them after their careers are done. But the young players, they'll see your name come up on the WhatsApp. It's like, oh fuck, is he asking me? Like, if he's asking me how I am, does that mean he wants to know if I'm doing that work he's asked me to do? I
Yeah,
might,
yeah.
it might, and the intention's nearly always just to find out how they are,
Yeah.
without too much of an agenda. But they will probably love. They will may well interpret that as, oh, he's fucking putting the he's pressing me down. He's putting pressure on me here. But
Yeah.
in fact, why doesn't he just cut to the chase? And I might not be, you
I
know.
know. I know, yeah.
And that's got to be careful of that. You're absolutely right.
And that's what I mean again, like you, like, and I want to say you, I mean you, plural, like me, you, another coach, like in our heads, our intentions are pure, like we're just purely interested. But in the player's head, their perception could be, fuck, is he testing me here? Or, you know, So, yeah, no, I just thought that's a very important piece. Because I would have been that kind of over-eager coach of like, yeah, how you doing? How you doing? How you doing? And like, you know, like, the, you know, then like someone says, man, you know, like some people think you're a bit too much. Like, you know, oh, really?
Oh,
Sorry.
mate,
You
100%.
know, yeah.
I'm definitely in that bracket as well.
Yeah. I'm very interested, Tom, just wrapping up here as well, is like, what do you do yourself just to look after yourself? Because, man, you know, no doubt you're in such a demanding job. I know there's probably pockets of the year where it's more intense than others, like obviously the Six Nations campaign, if there's a World Cup campaign, autumn campaigns, or if you have to go to do a summer tour or whatnot. But like, what do you do when you're in a very intense campaign with England? What are you doing personally, kind of just self-care wise, with your sleep and your training and your nutrition? And then I suppose when you do get a chance then to get a real chance to recharge the batteries, be around like loved ones, and kind of maybe get more time to look after your own training, because like obviously when I met you in Altus too, and I see you now right here on Zoom, like you look like a guy, well, not that you look, you are a guy who loves to train and looks after himself, and you know, so like
That's me.
So like, just from a self-care aspect, and it's just a lifestyle aspect. So lifestyle, we're talking about, you know, are you getting out, seeing the sun, some light and through the eye, helping your body clock? Are you sleeping? Are you getting your water? Are you getting nutrition? Are you getting your movement? And obviously, again, going back to context, there's times obviously throughout the year, no doubt, no different to myself, that you have more time to do a better job of that. And then you do notice, you've already made this sort of like agreement in your head. Listen, that 8 weeks is going to be later nights. Up early, sleep won't be as optimized, but I know that I'm gonna be, you know, I'm gonna have to be on it, and plus the fact, like, I'm gonna be in this 8 weeks, and it's gonna be great and intense, and I'm gonna love it, that you don't even notice like the maybe the lack of sleep or the nutrition that's good, because you're kind of in a go mode, but you also know at the back end of that, right, I'm gonna wind down, I'm gonna, you know, stretch a little more, get my mobility back, sleep a little bit better, drink a little more water, be around some more loved ones. You know, step away from the intensity. So, yeah, just overall, what do you do in the pockets when it's high intense, and then when you get out of those pockets and get a chance to wind down, what do those windows look like?
No, it's a good question. You make me think about it. I reckon I was shit out at this a few years ago. I would just battle on, and I was a martyr. Like hard work, head down, almost this ridiculous sort of representation of working all the time. And that was a bit of a cultural thing where we were working. And now I'm way more deliberate now, and I feel a hell of a lot better for it. So, I mean, things that work for me is like temperature shifting. So I love cold immersion in the morning. That really works for me. That gives me a massive rush to the point where I would get urges to do it in the middle of the day as well. Like when I'm probably a dopamine junkie, but I do that when I wake up. I write myself a training program that I'm accountable for during a campaign. So I've got it on my t on Team Builder on my phone, and I do it. Whereas before, I used to just fuck around and do a dumbbell pump or find a hill and just charge up the hill, 10 times. But now it's like I'm doing this. I said I would. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to be periodizing it. I'm not going to do star football on Wednesday because my knee's sore, and which would take me out of fucking action for 4 days if I did it. I love sauna, so I do sauna maybe 20 minutes a day. I'm conscious of my sleep, so I'm blocking all the blue lights out and getting into bed as early as I can. I hate breathing and mindfulness and all that shit, but because it's not my personality, but I do it, tiny bits of it. Especially if I'm in the cold, I'll do some stuff like that. But I can't sit there for 40 minutes, with my fingers crossed, inward, trying to concentrate on my pineal gland. I can't do that. I'm too introspective anyway, so I need to get out of my body. And that's training works for me. Walking, getting in the green, socializing, being with mates. Like I do a lot of walking at night after my last meal in camp. I do a lot of walking in the dark, just talking through stuff with the boys, staff, that is. So that's all really helpful. And when I come home, I try and keep the habits the best as I can from what I was doing in camp. So I still get up and jump in my ice tub outside. I'll still follow my training program. I'll try and, try and walk the dog at similar times. I just make sure there's just not this huge crash into home life and then trying to claw yourself back up. I used to do this thing where I'd get out of camp and I'd crash for 2 weeks. I couldn't exercise, couldn't do anything. I'd lie in bed until the kids were about to leave the house. I'd just be like, I'd be buggered. But now that's not happening because of I'm more deliberate. But you know what? Like you need a culture at work that appreciates it. Like there's still you can still see those people looking at you going like, oh fucking hell, like we're working and you're having an ice bath, or you're training when we're working. Like, yeah, but I was in meetings at X amount of time when you were training in the gym. So you've got to be a little bit selfless and a little bit single-minded in it, because with the best will in the world, some people look at you like judgy. Do you know what I mean? Especially if they're in the graft and in the grind and you're not in that moment. And just think to fail with them. Like we had a guy, we had Frank Dickin as a consultant for many years, and he was always really, really strong on making sure that you've got to be right to coach. It's a bit like that concept of when the air mask comes down the airplane, you can't help anyone if you haven't got any air. And I just think of it like that. I can't coach properly. I can't contribute in meetings. I can't be energetic for my family if I don't do this stuff. It looks selfish at the time, and it is a little bit, but you can offer more if you do.
Yeah,
So I've
as Paul Cech says, if you don't wear it, you can't share it. You know, if yeah, so
You got to eat in your own restaurant as well. Like
yeah.
I want to be in shape so that a player looks at me going, this guy, when he says do it, I know he's done it.
Yeah.
Like,
There is.
you can't be a dentist with rotten teeth. It doesn't make any sense. So
Yeah.
I'm mindful of that, and I just do all the stuff that I ask the boys to do.
Yeah, 100%. Now there is definitely something. There is definitely something to it. Yeah, I mean, sure. Like it's like, you know, we all have, I think, this inbuilt human dislike for do as I say, not as I do. I think everyone just revolts against that. It's like, dude, you
Yeah,
can
no.
say that. Yeah, if you can say that, but you don't live it, I ain't going into war with you. But it also reminds me of another. Stu's getting a few shout outs here today, but I remember this is still up on the Altus website. It was kind of like a presentation he gave about like kind of his training philosophy systems, whatnot. And he was like, in that presentation, he was like, here's how my training day starts. And it was basically like a snapshot of like his bedroom and like his alarm clock, or it was something to do with sleep. And he goes, yeah, my training day starts the night before. He was trying to get the point across that if I don't look after myself, like I'm not prepared. Like if I don't at least get some type of quality sleep in, some type of downtime, some type of time to reflect, you know, he's like, I'm no use to my athletes. And like at the time too, I was very much like into that because and again, as I got older, I've gotten more mellow, I'd like to think, you know, that I've gotten more into the realization, listen, the only thing that you can control is you. You know, you're like your circle of influence. But like when I was young, you know, when you're younger, you're a bit more like trying to save the world, you know, you should do this and you're shouldn't on people, you know. And it's like, listen, just you look after you, and then you know, you're doing your bit in the universe. But
That's true.
I just thought, like I was very similar. I'd be like looking around like coaches, and they're like whacking down the Red Bulls and the coffees, and they're not sleeping, and you know, and like they're not looking after their own exercise, their nutrition shit. And I'd be like, you know, you're telling you like if your athlete came to you in the condition that you're coming into, you would be like livid. You'd be like, what are you doing? And it's like, dude, you gotta like look after yourself first here. You know what I mean? So like I was,
Smart.
yeah,
Smart to do it.
the, yeah.
Smart.
So and when so when I saw that presentation from Stu, that's why it resonated so much of the time, because I felt like I was constantly repeating that to other coaches. I was like, man, you gotta look after yourself first here. I mean, you know, if you're not sleeping, if you're not hydrating, if you're not eating well, like again, and I get it, of course it's gonna be. And I see what people do is they do a scarecrow thing or a straw man argument here. They're like, well, like can't do that all that. Like, okay, don't go down. Like, don't like take it an inch and make it a mile. Like, we're not talking about that. Of course, there's times where like. You know, like say, like you're off with England and you're traveling. Of course, your body clock's going to be disrupted. Of course, there'll be times you get to the hotel late and you only get 4 hours sleep. It's like as long as that isn't the way you're living, like chronically, you know, you and like, you know, you should be healthy enough where acute disruptions to your schedule are actually good things for you. And that you know, it's like the whole anti-fragile concept from Taleb, that, you know, those little small, like little infractions, actually, you're so robust, anti, well, he thinks robust and anti-fragile are different, but you're so anti-fragile that they actually make you stronger. That's what we're looking for. You're adaptable to that. It's just that, like, if you are constantly in a chronic mode of stress because of poor sleep, nutrition, light exposure, just general stress management, that is going to be a problem. And then you're the person trying to promote or be a role model to your athletes, and it's just like they're like, as James Fitzgerald would say, is like, listen, man, they smell like the in
Oh, God,
they,
yeah.
like they smell that off you. They're like, I'm not buying that, dude. Like,
Yeah.
you're saying it, but I'm not buying it.
That's true. I remember a few years ago, one of the athletes grabbed my guts. He goes, oh, a little bit of there, are we? And I was like, I'm inside my body. I was like, fuck. What have I just thought, I fucking lost it. I've dropped everything. Like, it wasn't as bad as he said, but I knew in my mind, in that moment, what is that bloke thinking about what I'm asking him to do? Fuck the fact if I've got a little tire around my guts. But is he going to believe anything I say just because I'm in this position? I have to be an example. And I fail at that all the time. I know I do. But I'm trying to be a really good example.
But again, Tom, I just want to, I caution that with, like, we are human too. Like, you don't want to go all one way down, like, you know, that, yeah, like, I mean, it's you know, it's almost as if, like, now if you were walking out the gym and you had like a fucking half a Mars bar and said, oh, you're eating a Mars bar, you know, when people do that thing, like, I was like, dude, like, you know, I mean, there's, this is a whole conversation we could have for hours, because I've had this conversation with a number of people of, like, all right, define health. And like, that conversation, like, it's like fucking asking people what's fatigue and what's pain, you know, like, you know, people are like, well, what is fatigue? Is it, you know, oh, it's a lack of substrates. It's like, well, no, it's not. Is it the central government? We don't know. And it's like, what's pain? It's nociceptors. Okay, that's what gives it, but what is it? It's like, so it's like when you talk about health, it's like, well, health is like the lack of presence of disease. It's like, okay, I know loads of people that have no disease, but they're definitely not like healthy people. You know, because socially they're absolutely moronic. Like, they don't socialize. They, like, I mean, because you got to look at health. Like, there's a social aspect, of course. There's a nutritional aspect. There's a sleep aspect. There's an exercise aspect. But like, that social aspect's huge too. Like, so, like, the example I give is like, okay, let's say like you're mad in your sleep. Because I think when people think health, they automatically think like this monk lifestyle where like you eat like all just real food, whatever the fuck that means nowadays, and you know, you exercise optimally, whatever that means as well. You know, it's not too much bodybuilding because that's too sagittal plane. It's not too functional because you're not strong. You know, again, you can go on and on. And then it's like, but your sleep's perfect. But then again, you can also go out on a night out because you need to socialize and be with your friends and get endorphins and that. And it's like, there's this whole like layer, like as Dan says, there's like layers and layers to this thing. Like,
Very
so,
dynamic, very
yeah.
dynamic. Like my dad drinks pints with his mates a couple of times a week, but it's fucking hell, socially he's on point. Like, as you get into your later ages, you need company and
100%.
camaraderie. Like, you ha
Yeah.
like that's healthy of him to do that.
Like, the example I give too is that, like, so I've been reading a lot the last few couple of years, more probably 4, 3, 4, 5 years on chrononutrition, you know. So that's the science looking into like the times that we take our nutrients in at. And it's still in its infancy, but all the literature is very much skewed to saying that humans are designed to take the majority of their calories in earlier in the day. That metabolically we are more efficient, and we're better at partitioning our calories when we take them in early, in the earlier phases of the day. Like, our liver is just more efficient. Our whole metabolic aspect is, so basically, you know, like, you want to eat further away from your bedtime, and we seem to actually partition the calories better. Like, in terms of, like, you know, more of the calories are going into helping building leaner tissue. You have better insulin responses. Your postprandial insulin is much better. Whereas, like, if you eat the majority of your calories in the later half of the day, near to bedtime, you have worse metabolic markers, or you just don't partition those calories well, or digestion and metabolism as well. It's just, and again, it's a pretty decent data set at this stage. It's just they've done a lot of research in it. But I'm like, okay, you go tell people from Italy, France, and Greece not to eat 9 o'clock at night. Do you know what I mean? Because they sit down and it's their main meal. But like, it's like, okay, is this an isolation where like they're putting people like, okay, eat like the majority of your calories at 8 p.m. Just eat them all there. And like, you know, it's a 6 week study or whatever. So it's, first of all, it's 6 weeks. It's too short to like know what would happen over a lifetime. But it's like, it's out of context. It was like, okay, yeah, but when the people in Greece or Italy are eating, it's like, it's 8:30, 9 o'clock. It's social. There's a whole different like physiological contextual atmosphere to it, like where the bodies, you know what I mean? Like, it's like if you told them, oh, you can't have your family dues anymore, it's like, is that now healthy? Like, you know, going back to what is health? So
Oh.
there's just so much to it. Like, we're getting off our S&C conversation here, but
It's got very, very fucking hard to define, isn't it?
it's just yeah. Again, I go back to what Eddie Jones said, and it's nothing new to either of us, but context is king. But final thing I was gonna say, or one thing you brought up to me there was it's actually not the final thing, but it's almost the final thing. You were saying you like to go for a walk after your last meal when you're in camp with the lads and talk to them. It just got me thinking, like, obviously you have guys that you work with or maybe even work under you. So just from a communication aspect and building that rapport within your own sort of team within a team, what have you sort of like, how has that evolved at you over the years? Because even with me now, I'm a head coach now of a hurling team here, and there's three guys under me. And you're probably similar to me, and I think the listeners of this podcast and all, I'm very much about always making sure that those guys know how much I appreciate them and how wanted and valued they are. And but at the same time, that they're held to a high standard as well. And we want the best. We're trying to put the best environment forward for the team that we're involved with, that the lads that we're looking after, we're doing the best for them, and it's always their best interest in heart. So just with kind of your team within the team, like your guys in that sort of S&C aspect, like, no doubt, like, I mean, you got guys you're working with and working under you. So how have you sort of built a rapport and a sort of a relationship there?
Probably the best example is when I was managing. I had quite a large intern group at my previous job in Super Rugby. So we had at one point we must have had four or five interns, and it wasn't deliberate. It just kind of happened. But looking back at it, that saying, all work and no play makes Peter a very boring boy. So they need to know that you're not just the guy that comes in early, trains like a king, leaves and smashes a protein shake and then meditates and goes to bed, because they can't relate to it. Like, these are interns, they're in their final year at university. Like, they like a couple of beers at the end of the weekend. Like, they want to hear about mistakes you've made, and they want to have a laugh. So I remember we did quite a lot of stuff where we would train together, just shooting the shit. And if we had a if we were really down on CrossFit and they wanted to do CrossFit, we did CrossFit. Like, we just had a laugh, Like, we might talk about pure Olympic weightlifting, because at that point we were really into that, and then we're following all the old California strength videos and stuff like that. And we would get out of the work environment. This is in Australia, so we'd go surfing, we'd have a couple of beers, and we wouldn't talk about work, and we'd try to make things as informal as possible and pally. And that means that when you wanted to go formal, you could, because you weren't just formal all the time. So there was yin and yang. So, I mean, I know it's a bit of a crass term, but I did show vulnerability. I'd describe things like when I fucked up, and or I'd apologize if I was rude to them, or I barked at them, or somewhat. Like, try and lead example by saying how I'd done something wrong, or how what I did the day before wasn't great, so they could do the same. I'd ask for feedback on what they thought. I wasn't their leader. I was someone that I was kind of a pal, really. I was a mate. I could still, what's the word? I could still grind the axe or press some buttons if I needed to. And again, I didn't really know how I did it, and I'm not saying I nailed it or anything, but these guys all got together and bought me a watch when I was leaving for England, and I'm still in contact with them. I think it worked pretty well. And these guys are all really successful in Australia now. They've all got great jobs. I'm not saying it's because of me at all. They're all talented, smart lads. But if I was to do the same thing again, I would definitely not try and deviate from that path too much. I try and get people out for these walks in my current job, but they normally just crash and burn, and they don't want. They're not. It's, I'm not getting so much success doing that now. But it's terrible
I go.
walks.
I tell you, I'd go for those walks. I'm definitely a walker, so I'd be
Great.
up. Yeah.
It's good for digestion, like getting the night air in, clearing the cobwebs out of the day. It's a great idea. I'm into that. It's just more steps as well. Like, God, that can't be a bad thing.
What I take away from just your example there was, I know you said it kind of seemed like you were you were like, I don't really know why it worked, but it seemed to work. For me, what resonated to me, that was you were human. You kind of said you showed you were vulnerable. Like, I think again, and it kind of goes back to, I believe there's that inbuilt sort of aspect of humans where, like, we just appreciate authenticity. Like, that's what a lot of us kind of crave. Like, and again, it seems to be in humans too, we fucking hate superficial. We hate people that aren't authentic, and we mightn't consciously even think of that. It seems to be more like subliminal or subconscious. But when someone shows vulnerability, it's like, yeah, you're human. You're human. Like anytime, like I'm ever, if a friend to me is like, and recently, a friend of mine, she was like, she was kind of, it was almost, she was like confessing to a priest. She was like, I did something. She was telling me about a little lie she told, and like she, you know, she was kind of ashamed, and she, you feel guilty. You have to like commit your sins or like tell your sins to someone. And she was telling me, and she thought like that, like I was gonna be, oh, you should have done that. And I just said to her, I'm not gonna say her name here, but I just said to her, listen. Do you know what you are? And she was like she probably thought I was gonna say terrible. I was like, you're human. That's what you are. You're a human being. Like we all are fallible. Like we, like you know, we listen. We do great things. We do shitty things. We do good things. We do not so good things. You know, we've got beautiful skin and we've got warts as well on the backside. Like we're like, I was like, you're a human being. Don't like, this is all part of the journey. This is how you grow. And I'm just like, have you learned from this? And she's like, yeah. And I was like, there you go. This was a good thing. You learned, like it's you know, like it's just that seems to me, just from that story of the boys, you know, you were authentic, you were human, you were genuine. Maybe no actual physical words were said, but it kind of goes back to nearly what we spoke about offline when we were talking about our coaching experiences and kind of making our environments safe and fun. And it's very big right now because I'm studying PE to keep talking about the three aspects of cognitive psychomotor, but this third thing that most people forget is affective, which is the emotional aspect. And it kind of goes back to that saying, like people usually don't remember what you said or did, but they remember how you made them feel. And that was probably the case with those lads in Australia. Is like, you know, you might remember everything you said or did, but it's probably the way you conducted yourself. And it sounded like to me you were just genuine, you know. And when people see someone being genuine, it's like, oh, this dude isn't a robot that comes in and just tells us what to do, smashes workout, leaves, doesn't say goodbye to us, and smashes a protein shake and just says, be here tomorrow morning. He's a robot. Like, we can't relate to that. Whereas you're like, you went surfing, you told him, oh, sorry, boys, I fucked up there, my fault. Like, and because that's the way I like to coach with my lads. Like, even when I'm out, like, we've trained tonight now, and there's loads of times where I'd be setting up a drill and I'd be like, lads, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh shit, sorry, no, sorry, my bad, sorry, this way. You know what I mean? I think automatically they're like, oh, like, he just, you know, he admits to it straight away. Like, you know. So I just think people, they respect that. They like that. You know, it's just genuine. It's human. It's authentic. You know, we all have our great points or not great points. And I just think authenticity is what people buy into, you know? So it sounds like you did a great job with that.
Authenticity and genuinity, it's a powerful attractor, isn't it?
Oh, huge. Yeah.
Definitely attracted to people that are themselves to you.
Yeah. Well, I
Not
mean,
this
like,
very thing for distrust.
right now, I mean, some people might say just because me and you are the two guys online here, and obviously, look, this always happens on a podcast. We've had a great conversation. We're stimulated. We're there's good energy going across the internet waves here. So obviously, the vibes here are great. But I mean, dude, we've only met in person once. It was 7 years ago, and because I feel both of us are so authentic, it's basically like we've been mates in another lifetime in all our lives. It's like this is like only like our third, fourth, fifth interaction in like 7 years. It's like I might as well have seen you yesterday. Do you know what I mean? That
I
like
don't
it's it,
think.
it's it's so easy just to connect and talk, and there's a lot of resonance there. So
Well, it's a
that's great.
big problem with SSC, mate, isn't it?
Oh yeah.
Like they need to be superheroes.
Yeah.
They need to, like I said, be monks. They need to be right about fucking everything. They need to be in shape. They need to be very well learned. They need experience that they don't have. So, fuck, mate, so it can be a bastard of an industry to be in if you're your own coach.
Yeah. Have you looked at much into Craig White's work? Remember the former Welsh guy, the former Welsh S&C?
Yeah, I've been up to Hebden Bridge a few times to have dinner with him.
Oh, he's a
I
great dude. That must have been
love
great.
his again. I love his attitude and his approach to how you support men. I think it's great. I think
Brilliant.
he was a he's a great coach, still
Brilliant.
is, and he's been very successful. Like his trophy cabinet's vast,
Yeah.
so I pick his brains whenever I can.
Yeah, his stories. I loved his background. So, and for people that don't know, that's Craig White, Men Behind Masks. I'll link up to his stuff because there's a few podcasts I listen to, and again, there's so much there that resonated with me. And because I've had very similar conversations to around his work with lots of people. So I didn't even know that. I'm not surprised that you've linked up with him because it makes sense knowing you. But I'd say that was a great experience, Tom. I won't keep any longer because we're 50 minutes over, and no doubt you've got stuff to do. And that was amazing. Such a great conversation. Sorry, we went off on one talking about health and Greek and Italians having dinner at 9 o'clock. But just
Fun,
before I go, curious to know too, and maybe because you're after coming off the Six Nations campaign, so you mightn't have anything on hand. But what are you reading any good books at the moment, or Have you what would be your top and current reading recommendations if you have been reading at all, or what has been your last ones?
Well, I'm anticipating Danny Foley and Matt Ulrich's Drop of the Fascia Mechanics, which is a course that
Oh,
they're
okay.
producing. I read a lot of their work, and I'm excited to get stuck into that. I'm actually reading at the moment a book called The Unsold Mindset,
Oh.
and it's like a sales book, but it's got loads and loads of coaching applications to it.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of the stuff we've been talking about, actually. So I'm making my way through that. If I look at my desktop, I reckon I've got 30 web pages open of articles. I'm just sitting there waiting to read.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, a lot of Altus content.
Yeah.
What else? I've got this book that I've read twice called that I think I'm going to read for a third time because I just keep coming back to that. It's The Courage to Be Disliked, which is a Japanese author. I can't remember the full name, but it's just got so many learnings about how to be a really good guide, support, resource, coach. It's got so many points in it, and also it's got a lot of Stoic, Adlerian psychological points to it, which will help you sort of rationalize things a little bit more when you can catastrophize little moments, which aren't as big as you think they are. I'm gonna be that for a third time. And what else, Robbie? I've got a bucket load of podcasts. I've just saved that I need to get stuck into. It's all strength and power, nauseating and whatnot. I've got a load of videos from Dan Pfaff and the Altus Group that I still need to watch that I can now get done once I've left. The fashion stuff is probably my big interest at the moment.
Great. Yeah, that's what you're onto now. That's good. Yeah, that's brilliant.
Hopefully.
Tom, absolutely brilliant. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. I will if there's anyone that wants to reach out to you, Tom, is there any best place they can get a hold of you?
Yeah, DM Instagram.
I'll stick that in the show notes.
At Tommy Tumble on X. You can try my Hotmail, which is just my name, tomthomson@hotmail.com. But I'm getting some weird shit coming through there these days about like Ukrainian women and like Indian online casino invitation. I don't know. I think it's been hacked. Something's going on there. So I might hear you, I might not if you email me on that. But
Yeah.
probably social media, to be fair.
Yeah, Instagram might be safer bet. Okay, I'll say goodbye to you offline. But for everyone listening, unreal conversation with Tom and an absolute wealth of knowledge and just an absolute gentleman. Really, really humble guy. Delighted that we finally made time for this stuff. Tom, really appreciate it.
Thanks, Rob. I enjoyed that. Thank you.
All right. I'll say goodbye to you offline. Okay, for everyone else, till next time, take care, be well, and stay strong.